You can't hear anything because I'm not saying anything. Very good. I just watch the lips. Okay, let's start then. So this is second morning's talk, and the reason I went out there because if I don't see a nice question in the basket, I always like to talk about that in the next opportunity. As you may all know, can you see okay? Very good. As you all know that whenever you teach, you don't have a set course. You do this today, that another day, and something else the next day. Because sometimes you get feedback from people, from the questions, from the interviews, just by looking at you, to find out exactly what is needed. So we're always willing to adapt to every possibility as the day and the week progresses. And so I like the questions because then I can see something about what's going on. And the question last night, which I wanted to base most of the talk on this morning, what is right mindfulness? Conversely, what is wrong mindfulness? How do I remain mindful of thoughts and thinking without killing the thought process or destroying creativity? And this is because there has been like a mindfulness-based therapy, there has been just things from the Vipassana tradition, and for many of you who have listened to my teachings a lot, I just really argue against those ideas because they're not as I understand the Dhamma, they're not as I understand the teachings of the Buddha, and they're not as my teacher Ajahn Chah used to teach. So mindfulness, apart from all the other factors which precede it, what comes afterwards, doesn't really bite. It doesn't really sort of get to the heart of what we're here for. So the right mindfulness, we call it right, the right and wrong, it is relative to what we're wanting to achieve. And what we're trying to sort of go for here, there is stillness from which deep meditation comes from. And from that deep meditation, the jhanas, that's actually where enlightenment comes from. And you hear me say many, many times, when I quote the suttas, when I quote those suttas, it just makes it very, very clear, you know, why we need that deep stillness of jhanas in order to see things as they truly are. I did mention that in passing, the first night, it's a Pali phrase. I have to quote Pali phrases just because it gives me cred. Otherwise, people think, oh, Ajahn Brahm just tells jokes. He just talks with teddy bears. What's teddy bears got to do with enlightenment? A huge amount. What's the answer? It's just too soft a retreat. It's not too soft a retreat. It's just about the right amount of tension and relaxation. You create your tension, struggling and striving, and I've got to somehow try and relax you, try to make you a bit more sensitive and kind. So mindfulness, yes, it's part of the Eightfold Path. It's the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. But it is only one factor of the Eightfold Path, and it's certainly not the most important. The whole path is important. If anything is the most important, it's probably the first factor, the right view. What are you doing this for? Where are you coming from? Why we're doing this? And it is learning how to let go. So, the two types of meditation. Sometimes I ask people, what are the two types of meditation? And I don't want to be mean today, because some people have had a nice breakfast. So some people say that they put their hands up, it's never to be Vipassana. Wrong. Please, if I ask you a question, never answer it. It's never exactly what you think. So what is the two types of meditation? It's not samatha vipassana, they're one and the same. Okay, the story that is always like increasing these stories, and I think elaborating, letting them grow because of the nature of things. And it was Venerable Bodhidatta, he told me himself yesterday, he saw some little article about the power of stories. If I give you like a theory, then people actually get into the challenging mode. They listen to it and straight away they start finding fault with it. That's our nature, our critical mind. But when you tell a story, after a little while, you're more interested in the story and actually the teachings. Actually, they come almost under your radar and you've heard them before you even start thinking and challenging them. That's why storytelling is always one of the most powerful ways of transmission of a concept or an idea, because it takes it right into something which you can associate with, relate with. Theories are always a little bit like balloons flying in the air, not tethered to the ground. So, the story of the couple, Sam and Vi. They were living together for a long time, and Sam, oh, let's even change it to, is this, yeah, why not, Sam and V. And these were two males who were living together. We've got to sort of bring these teachers into the modern age. So Sam and V, two really good friends, nice gay couple. And of course they didn't have any kids. They had two dogs. Two dogs, yeah. Two dogs, yeah. And one of those dogs was called Mecca, and the other dog was called Anapana. Breath. So, Sam and V, they decided to go up a meditation mountain one afternoon, up to Mardi Mountain. And Sam, he went up there because he just liked a peaceful life. Sam, he went up there for the calm and the stillness. His partner V, he went up there because he had great views. He was like an amateur photographer. And he took his amazing state-of-the-art, not one of these little iPhones, but like Canon with all these really expensive cameras with all these super photo filter lenses and stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about, but you get the idea. He went up there to get some nice photographs to see the view, because the higher you get, the more you see. And Meta, the dog, it was a nice little dog, just went up there for just some exercise. You know what dogs are like? They don't have to have a purpose to go up there. They just go up there for fun. And Anapana really did need some exercise, because Anapana Sati, you know, was Anapana, was a little bit fat and heavy breathing, so he really needed to get up there to get some exercise for his lungs. So the four of them went up Meditation Mountain. And when they got halfway up Meditation Mountain, oh, Sam, you could appreciate the quietness. The quietness was just so amazing. But of course, Sam had a pair of eyes, can see the great view. And V, his partner, he got out his camera, and even though there was much better views further up, but still, this was amazing, just how far you could see halfway up Samadhi Mountain. Metta, oh, Metta was wagging her tail stronger and stronger and more and more, because Metta was just having such a wonderful time. Even halfway up Meditation Mountain, it was just so gorgeous up there. And Anapana, the fourth dog, you know, it was really hard of breathing. It was just, you couldn't almost see any breath there. And when they got up to the top of Meditation Mountain, Anapana, the dog, had vanished. Couldn't be found anywhere. Because the breath vanishes in deep meditation. Metta, the dog, wow, she was so blissed out. Wagging her tail, but quietly, wagging her tail, And she could see in her eyes she was so happy, so full was metta at the top of Meditation Mountain. Sam? Oh, it was so still up there. Nothing moved at all. But Sam had a pair of eyes and could see the great views and also experience the bliss which the dog was experiencing on the top of Meditation Mountain. And he also was taking incredible photographs, but it was so quiet, so still, it's like the shutter never made any noise, but still was recording these incredible views. The whole universe, the meaning of life, everything was laid out in front of V. But he could also experience incredible joy up there, incredible metta, pure love, emptiness, stillness, up on the top of Meditation Mountain. And the meaning of that story is, when you go up Meditation Mountain, samatha, vipassana, metta, things disappearing like the breath, that's what happens the further you go up. The more joy, the more peace, the more insight. You cannot separate them. Ajahn Chah, he put his hand up like this, and he said, now you see the front of my hand. And then very quickly, now you see the back of my hand. You can only see the back of my hand, but I guarantee, he said, the front is still there. Now you see the front, you can't see the back, but the back is still there. Samatha vipassana, samatha vipassana. One may go in front, the other one goes right behind. You can't have one without the other. So, what is right mindfulness? So, I got right mindfulness here. So, this is from that word of the Buddha, which one day I'll finish if I ever get any time. What now is right mindfulness? The four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. People who say the only way to enlightenment, that is just so much gomayang. It is not acceptable, it is not supported by the text, it is a very bad translation, and any monk who says that should go back to Pali class. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana. What are the four? Having restrained the five hindrances. You abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful, having restrained the five hindrances. You abide aware of experience, vedana, abide aware of the mind, citta, and you abide aware of mind objects. The most important thing about that, to have real right mindfulness, you have to restrain the five hindrances. So, what do we mean by that? Restraining the... Why is that necessary? Because if you are dull, that's the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. Are you mindful? Oh, I'm peaceful. I'm in jhana. It must be jhana. Because I can't feel anything. It's not. The jhana is incredible mindfulness. More mindful than you've ever been before. Restless? How can you be restless? What's going on? When you are, remember that simile of going up Kingsbury Drive, fast, going through the window, looking through the window of a speeding car, you hardly saw much. But when you stopped and were still, that's when the mindfulness really started to come up. And the other question they asked yesterday about the joy, that is one of the best indicators that you are really mindful. Because you're joyful, you're happy. This is one of the reasons why people get depressed. And why mindful meditation can sometimes be a great antidote to depression. Why is that the case? It is because... Look, here's one. I went to UK one of the first times, and being really stupid, I went at Christmas time. And Christmas time was like Chinese New Year, or like Sri Lanka New Year, or whatever. It's when you go and visit your family. So I thought, go and visit family over at Christmas time. But I forgot what London was like at that time of the year. It was miserable. It's actually quite far up in the Northern Hemisphere. And so I'd forgot that I used to go to school 9 o'clock in the morning in the dark. And 3 o'clock now, about 3:30 when the school finished, and it was dark again. You only had a couple of hours of sunlight, 3 or 4 hours at that time of year. Summertime was great. But summertime, sometimes, you know, it was light all night. And it was really hard for my mother to get us in to go to bed. But it's still light, Mum. We can still play soccer. No, you go to bed, it's 11 o'clock, but it's still light. So that's, you know what, but it was so miserable, so grey and dark, and the weather was, it never actually really did anything properly, not real rain, you know, like a real storm. It was just like drizzle, drizzle. It was true. And you go there, you know, you don't have anything painted, no colour anywhere. All the trees, the green leaves had all gone. The sky, you can never see a blue sky, it's all grey. All the houses, grey stone. Grey. People used to wear grey clothes, you know, just hats, grey hat, grey scarf, grey overcoat. Everything was so grey, and even the tea they drank was Earl Grey. Everything was grey and miserable. And so I remember my brother sort of talking to me after he picked me up from the airport. And he said, you know, they found that a lot of depression happens at that time of the year. And it's called seasonal affective disorder. SAD. You know, it's a good acronym. And you know how they cured it? They got all these people who were depressed at that time of the year, put them into a room, turned up the bright lights, made them wear Hawaiian shirts, you know, anything really colourful, and played really no loud hip-hop exciting music. And that got them out of their depression. They just needed some stimulation to get some happiness coming. Stimulation of their senses, more mindfulness. And when the mindfulness came, energy came with it. And that's why even these days, people who are really sort of tired, they've been working hard, you give them a cup of coffee. Vitamin C, I call it. Vitamin K. And then afterwards, you feel really happy and bright. Sometimes that really happens. And so, if you understand the link between the energy and the mindfulness and happiness, then you can understand an important part of the teachings. Why? The happiness is a sign of mindfulness, strong mindfulness, energetic mindfulness. However, if you are dull, you can see on people's faces, they're tired, they're exhausted, they haven't got much happiness or energy. And that is, you can see where depression comes from. So, this is actually where we understand the mindfulness. To really get it strong, you have to associate it with joy. So, the other question people asked me the other day, what was it? Here we go. This is the Anapanasati Sutta. Okay. And how does mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated complete the four focuses of mindfulness? When the in-breath and out-breath are long, and you're aware that they are long, when the in-breath and out-breath are short, and you're aware that they are short, when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body. In the category bodies, that is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. And then next, of the four Satipatthanas, these are the ones who ask these questions, is when you learn to experience joy, as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience the mental formation of piti sukha, happiness and pleasure as you breathe in and out. Why is it called mental formation? It is because the happiness is not in the breath. The breath is just breath. It's just the power, the perception, what the mind sees in it. And later on you get all my stories of when the mindfulness is very strong. You can go outside and the first plant you see blows your mind. Wow, it's incredible, it's so beautiful. You see the clump of bamboo like in that story I said over in first meditation retreat, and oh, that was an amazing clump of bamboo. Or even better, the old story, you know what's coming, don't you? Well, after a nice meditation here in Jhana Grove, I went to the toilet and I looked in the toilet bowl. And I don't know if anyone was there next to me at the time, but wow! Never in my whole life have I ever seen such a beautiful piece of feces. I'll be quite polite now, but next time I say it, I'll get really into it. But now that was absolutely true. And I couldn't understand what was going on. I was just enjoying it. How can some of the most disgusting, dirtiest thing look so delightful? The thing in itself wasn't beautiful, but it was the mental formation, how the mind looked at it. Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder, it's in the mind of the beholder. That's how things work. So anyway, you experience this joy and happiness. And then, of course, you learn to calm this mental formation as you breathe in and out. You just stabilize it. And then, of course, you get into the next satipatthanas, which are the nimittas, the jhanas. But anyway, so that right mindfulness. So how do I remain mindful of thoughts and thinking without killing the thought process or destroying creativity? If you have thoughts and you get involved in the thinking process, thereby you are killing creativity. You only think of old stuff. You can't think of anything new because the thoughts. This is the old, I've got one here. This is the old simile, which I've used a lot. And this was a simile which really got people going and made me I get a really nice reward for our Buddhist monastery. I was invited to the 2015 or 16, I forget now, World Computer Congress in Daejeon, South Korea. Ajahn Brahm, an expert on computing. So it was a keynote address. You know, you got the welcoming by the chairman, blah, blah, blah. And now we introduce Ajahn Brahm, who's going to set the theme for this conference over in Daejeon. And yeah, they pay business class tickets, a really nice hotel, and afterwards I was so impressed, they gave a $2,000 donation to the Buddhist Society. Now, I never asked for that. They said, oh, really good, people like you. So, you know, it's amazing what they used to call a nice little learner. And so, as soon as I got this, you know, people said, what the heck are you doing here? You know, never heard of you in the computer magazines. So I told them what creativity is, because creativity, innovation, that's so important. And this is actually what I did. What is this? I did in front of about 400, 500 IT experts, PhDs, professors, goodness knows what else. And what is this? And people said, bottle, plastic, bad for the environment, blue cap. Oh, don't know, you keep on saying all these sorts of things. Yeah, keep on, what else do you see? 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 Until eventually they ran out of thought. The word stopped. Everything they've been told, all their vocabulary, which they assumed could actually describe and capture something, all that ran out. And they were silent. I said, okay, now you're beginning to see what this is. Remember, thinking goes around the object. It never actually penetrates anywhere. This really is old conditioned, habitual ways of looking at something. What you've been heard at school, what you've been taught by the TV, radio, culture, what you've been taught by me as well. Just thinking. It never really gets into stuff. So I really appreciated that. That was worth $2,000 US. You get it for free here. They don't do it for money. But that's why the thinking process can only take you so far. And you've got to stop that and be silent. Okay, here we go. Another little exercise which many of you experienced before. But it's great. You can share this with friends. If ever you do any meditation classes, teach people, therapy, whatever, I don't mind these teachings being shared. You've got no sort of copyright on them. But this was teaching people what it means not to think. So when I'm speaking, I want you to be aware of what's happening inside your mind as I'm speaking. Because you'll begin to notice spaces between my words in those pauses. Were you thinking? Or are you just aware without giving anything a name or description? You're just aware, that's all. That's really cool. It's so easy to do. And people get it straight away. The reason is because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. So that's why there it was again. You couldn't think. All that verbalizing just went out the window. It stopped. And you were aware, you were here. And not sort of trying to capture things with names which cannot be captured at all. So because of that, that's why the thinking is the problem. So we learn how just to relax from the thoughts. Which gets you into how do you actually to let go of thinking. Because it is almost like enemy number one. It's not quite enemy number one, but it's very close to enemy number one in meditation. So how do we understand that? Number one, we should just somehow or other, just all those thinking, just how many problems has it got you into? You know, thinking, I'm right, they're wrong. No, 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 they're wrong, I'm right. It's amazing. Why do people always have to be right? Even though they know they're wrong, but they still have to be right. Because it's an attack on your deepest assumption of who you are. To admit you're wrong. To admit you've got a failure. To admit you're not quite right. Because we have been in our culture, when you were kids, you make a mistake, you get punished. If you don't even get punished, you get humiliated. They call you stupid. You make a mistake in maths, in English, you spell it wrong, and you know, you feel terrible about that. It's almost like being right is part of having a good ego. And being a failure, being wrong, challenges who you're supposed to be in this world. That's why people always hide their mistakes. Because they think it's a personal failure. No, a flaw in who they think they are. So because of that, people always argue. And anyway, it's not seeing the truth anyway. So what we do, we learn how to be quiet, silent. What was it? Okay, yeah. There was, I had an interesting childhood. Sometimes that, you know, things go wrong in your life, you have difficulties and problems, but you always, you know, you take that on board and you learn from it. But anyway, just one of my friends, as you all know, was Bernard Carr. He was a good mate, very close associate of Stephen Hawking's. But what he never told Stephen Hawking's was that he was the Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics, Queen Mary College, London University. But he was also the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. So he's on the committee of the Psychic Research Society. And the Psychic Research Society, they never have any trouble in their meetings because they can always hypnotize each other, or they can use, they know exactly what you're thinking before you say it. You don't even have to, if you're psychics, you don't even have to advertise the date of the meeting. If you're any good, you know where it's going to happen and when. Well, this was actually not psychics, it's people investigating psychic phenomena. So that was my hobby too. So that's why I met this fellow, joined up at the Buddhist Society, saw him at the Psychic Research Society, Astronomical Society as well, so we got into the same things. But when we caught up again at the last global conference we had here in Perth, when was that? A couple of years ago, wasn't it now? Anyway, he just, you know, we hang out together, haven't seen each other for a while, and we were just, he said this amazing experiment, which I often quote, done at, London University? Imperial College in London. Imperial College, London, is like a tech university. But, you know, really high quality, is way up there in the university rankings. And it was one of his friends, you know, another professor, he was said they discovered levitation and was going to demonstrate in one of the lecture theatres of Imperial College in front of as many top experimental scientists he could gather, under laboratory conditions, with the cameras and videos rolling, with everything just, you know, just check us out, how levitation works. And so he came into the lecture theatre with a flower pot. And he put the flower pot, had a flower in it, put it on the desk, just carried it in, no wires, put it on the desk. And he managed, because he had a good reputation, he wasn't a crazy fella, they get all these other professors to come in. You know, these lecturers, well-known sort of experimental scientists, to come in and fill the seats of this lecture theatre. And then he said, we're now going to demonstrate levitation. Turn on the cameras. He said, now, I need your help, because one person can't levitate this. So I need all of your help. I want you all to start chanting. Om. So all of them started chanting, Om, Om. And I wish we had a videotape of all these old professors and lecturers sitting there going, Om, 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 Om. But you know what happened? As they were chanting Om, the flower pot levitated above the table. It actually worked. They filmed it, they photographed it, the flower pot levitated. Unexplainable. And afterwards, you know, when the flower pot went down, they stopped chanting. They asked many of, they showed the, you know, the photographs and the video, and many of those professors said, no, it never happened. It was on the table all the time. It never lifted. What are you talking about? Look, here's the photograph. No, that's been photoshopped. Now here's a video. No, that's just been fake video, fake news. And they refused to admit what had actually happened. It had actually levitated. Because it was so much against what they felt was possible. It challenges their views so much they just couldn't see it. It was impossible. It was impossible, therefore it didn't happen. Forget the facts. Can't happen, you see it, therefore it didn't happen. Now, of course, for those who've heard this story before, what was really behind this, it wasn't an experiment on levitation, it was an experiment on perception. Because what had really happened, underneath that big wooden desk, they had installed a huge, powerful electromagnet. And of course, whenever you turn on such a very powerful current, you can hear it. It hums. So they had to get people to chant, just so they wouldn't be busted, to know that this was a trick. It was just a very powerful electric current, that's all. So when you went om, they couldn't hear the ampage. All they could hear was the ohms from the professor, not the ohms going through the resistors. So, anyway, that was actually worked. Because even though it happened, people would deny it. It was just too challenging. Now that goes to the heart of how, if you're really going to have mindfulness and see what's really there, all of your wants and not wants, they have to be suspended for a while. You have to restrain those five hindrances which block perception, which change it. So you just see what you want to see. And you can't see, you know, what is just too hard for you to see. That's the problem of the hindrances. So if you haven't suppressed those hindrances, you can't trust your mindfulness. There is no such thing as bare awareness other than with the teddy bears. When you are aware, what comes to your mind has already been filtered. It's already been bent. What you see, you think. What you're seeing is truthful. It's non-judgmental. But even to come to your awareness, it's already been judged, filtered, bent. That's the truth of the matter. Ask any psychologist. What is it? Us. Okay, all my little confessions of when I was a young man. I had my first pint of beer, British beer, when I was 14 years of age. Pushing boundaries, it's illegal. But you know, you had to do that peer pressure. It wasn't dangerous, but it was just not right. But I was so disappointed. You know, the taste of British beer for the first time, it tasted really disgusting. Why do people spend so much money and go out for their evening drinking this, you know, rubbish? I was going to say something else, but... But, you know, in 6 months, I learned how to like it. Because I had to. I had no choice. It was peer pressure. You had to like it. And so it started tasting good. I remember just going to... I was Roly Stone Primary School a long time ago. They wanted me to go and give a talk to the kids on Buddhism. And I don't mind doing that, but you know, sometimes, because you're busy sometimes, you do, you know, fail to actually ask exactly what you expected to do. It was primary school, so they put me in this hall with the combined grade 1, grade 2s to teach them Buddhism. Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? These were like 5, 6, 7-year-olds. Actually, no, just grade 1, it was 2 classes of grade 1, sorry. That's even worse. How can you teach Buddhism to grade 1s, an whole 50 or 60 of them? But you know, sometimes you like a bit of a challenge, and of course, when I take these challenges and it doesn't work out, I don't tell you about them. It's only when it actually works out something happens I use it, for an example. So, I was up there, I thought, what am I going to do? And so I just did a little experiment, and I said, how many children like rice pudding? Rice pudding. And so about three or four kids put their hand up. They didn't like rice pudding was the question. How many children don't like rice pudding? About 3 or 4 kids put their hand up. And then you know what happens in grade ones? All the other kids looked around. Okay, yeah. No, I agree, I don't like rice pudding. Yeah, me too, I don't like rice pudding. And in about 2 minutes, 60 kids had their hand up. We all agree they did not like rice pudding. It's, you know, peer pressure. Delusion. Then I said, okay, put your hands down. Now, how many children here have ever eaten rice pudding? And about 6 kids put their hands up, and everyone else laughed. including the parents, the kids got it. We judge, well, we don't, haven't even had rice pudding yet. But the class has agreed it's bad, therefore we agree it's bad. We haven't even tried it yet. Well, it's good, and we haven't even tried it. Oh yeah, it must be really cool. That is how the hindrances work. And we think that we're being objective. We ain't. We're bending the truth to suit us for all sorts of different purposes. It's just like, I always thought I was rebellious when I got my green velvet trousers to go to the Isle of Wight Rock Festival. I mean, rebellious, you know, fluorescent green velvet trousers. That's really cool. And being a rebel, you're not supposed to wear things like that. And of course, as soon as I got to this big Isle of Wight Rock Festival, I saw about 1,000 other young men wearing green velvet trousers as well. It was just another uniform, a uniform of rebellion. Oh, just, you can't win. But it really challenged me about just what mindfulness is. So real mindfulness, number one, it has to be energized, powerful, and joyful. That's a good sign. And also, it has to be able to be challenging. You don't see what you expect to see. You see things which are totally, wow, very challenging. So, now at this point you might as well start talking about that great poet, it wasn't W.B. Yeats. I remember who it was in a moment. Who, one of his poems was, there's two parts of that poem, which a very long poem, and the one part which I very rarely quote, but it was political, and that was like, vengeance to the tyrant fled, and caught the tyrant in his bed, and slew the wicked tyrant's head, and became a tyrant in his stead. It's like revenge. You see that throughout history. And anyway, William Blake was the poet. He's also an artist as well, 17th century. He was also one of the same poem later on. He wrote the famous words, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. And I loved that, because that was challenging. And he was pointing out something which, you know, in meditation you experience. To see a world in a grain of sand. Sometimes, you know, you go out there, you're so mindful, so aware. You look at a grain of sand, it's amazing what's going on in there. A tiny speck of sand. You see, it's not just a dot, it's serrated, different colours, it's shaped, it's got texture. And you see a whole world there. And you can look at that for I don't know how long. That's why that. If people don't know what you're doing, they think you're crazy. Please always remember that don't always live in the present moment. Because, you know, I've done that for years, training in Thailand. And it was the case. I didn't know what year it was. You didn't have to. You know, people say, no, is it 19-something? I said, well, I don't know. This wasn't important to you. And days of the week, you just know the moon days, how many more days it was to the next full moon. You know, that's all you knew. And then I came over to Perth, and our first place, you know, there was a poor gentleman, he was Nepalese, I still remember him, and he had an epileptic fit, you know, in the garden when I was there, and Ajahn Chah was somewhere else. And so he called the ambulance, and the ambulance men came, and, you know, he had to go to the hospital, had an epileptic fit. And I remember they looked at him, and they said, what's your name? What day of the week is it? He said, I don't know. And I asked him, why do you ask that? That's a standard question. If they ask you what day of the week it is and you don't know, that's straight away in the ambulance to therapy. Oh my goodness. If they'd have asked me, I'd have been in the back of the ambulance with him. I didn't know what day of the week it was, but you know, that wasn't because I was sick, maybe, but it was because, you know, I was living in a different realm of meditation and just letting go. So please, always remember what day of the week it is. And when they come up and ask you, you know, who are you? They said, I'm Kanda. That's all I am. I am emptiness. I don't care who I am. I've let go. in the back of the van. You've got to be careful. So anyway, the right mindfulness is, you know, when you see a world in a grain of sand, and joy, the pleasure, see a heaven in a wildflower. Now, you know wildflowers, Australia's, West Australia's supposed to be famous for wildflowers all over the place. But they're tiny. And you think, this, how can it be like a whole heaven or something so little, so humble, just hiding, just between the big pieces of grass or the rocks. They're just almost like so shy. You look at them and they're absolutely gorgeous. But you have to really look and allow the mind just to just settle on it. Just like to find out what it really is. Wildflower, someone might call it weed. It's weed, isn't it? But no, you stop and look. Allow the mind to settle on there, to challenge your perceptions. And then you see a heaven in a wildflower. You see a beauty friend in a dangerous snake. There's one of those stories, actually in the book, I haven't told it for such a long time. One of the early years I was here in Perth, I was invited to go and give a talk at an old people's home in Pinjarra. And in this old people's home, there was, after giving a little talk, just hanging out lots of time and just having a cup of tea with one of these really old people. And he was actually saying, because I'd told the stories of, you know, the people like Ajahn Gunha patting snakes and stuff. And he said, oh yeah, I've got a similar story. This was years ago, I don't know, maybe about 80, 90 years ago, maybe 100 years ago now. He said one of his friends was, you know, in down south somewhere, and, you know, when they have the, you still see those houses in Mount Lord in North Perth, they're just on stumps. They raise the floor above the ground, put a sort of a platform, and that's where they build the house. And he said, you know, his mate was out at work, you know, that's how he knew him, he was his working friend, and they had a little daughter, maybe about 4 or 5 years of age, and she would go up to her mummy, mummy, can I have some milk? And, oh yeah, of course you can have some milk, but can I have it in a saucer, please? And mummy was very busy. It was not really the usual thing you drink milk from a saucer, but mum was really glad that her child was drinking something reasonably healthy. So the little five-year-old, thank you, mummy, and she took the saucer of milk outside. And she did that for 3 or 4 or 5 days. It was a bit unusual. So the next day, mother sort of followed her. What she was doing with the milk, why drink it outside? And she found out that the child wasn't drinking it. The child went around the back of the house, knelt down, put the saucer of milk on the ground, and called out to its friend. And out from underneath the house, a tiger snake came out. Get the milk. Tiger snakes are very venomous. And the mother, you know how much a mother loves a child, will do anything for the child, froze because she was so afraid that just, you know, one little bite and the child was gone, was dead. But she never didn't want to show her fear, because if she showed her fear, then, you know, her worst possibility might actually happen. So she just was really still and just watched in horror as the tiger snake drank the milk. And afterwards the little girl said goodbye to her friend and then took the saucer away. That's why I wanted a saucer. That's why I wanted the milk, to feed its friend. And so she told her father, her husband the next day, and her husband said, leave it to me. When the kid asks for the milk, do it as usual. And so she gave the milk to the child the next day. The child, thank you, mummy, took it outside, put it down, called out to its friend. And the tiger snake came out to get its milk. Bang! And the tiger snake's head was blown off. because the father was waiting with a gun and shot the tiger's head off right in front of the little girl. After that, the little girl just could not eat, refused to eat. They took her to the local hospital in Pinjarra, that's just south of here. And this old fellow said the girl fretted, there was a word those days, fretted, was worried, nothing physically wrong with it, but just so upset, depressed, and died in the hospital. Just would not eat, didn't want to live. They saw the tiger snake blown off right in front of it, traumatized. Do you think, I actually asked the, please excuse me, I asked this old fellow, he said, do you think that tiger snake would have ever killed, bitten that young girl? And the old man said, not bloody likely. He knew enough about, you know, what it was like to make friends and be kind. Perceptions. Be careful. It's not just bare mindfulness. Before it comes to our attention, we add so much. That is why we do need to get rid of or suppress, restrain the five hindrances first of all. No anger or ill will, no wanting, peaceful, not restless, clear, understanding what's going on, not doubt. And then we find that mindfulness is strong, penetrating. We see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, even a little state. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. That's a nice one. All the meanings of life, right here. Not in a book. Not in the teachings of Ajahn Brahm. Not in philosophy. Right here, in the palm of your hand. And eternity in an hour. If the only reason said hour, because that rhymed with what was the other one? Flower, wildflower. What it means is timelessness. Eternity in a moment. And that is also so powerful, because when you get into deep meditation, you're timeless. Your time has no meaning anymore. And often as a physicist, you started to think, what actually is time? Time is only a measurement between the past and the future, or the past or the present, or the present and the future. You need past and future, or past or future, to have any idea what time is. If you're totally in the present moment, right now, it's like, it's no time at all, but it's also eternity. It's timeless. The disappearance of time. You're right here, right now. I mean, really right here, right now. And nothing moves. To move, it has to have a destination. In the future somewhere. Have a goal. Wanting, craving. You have to have somewhere you want to be. Next, in the future. Just imagine what it must be like. You don't want anything in the whole world. Nothing is pulling you into the future. No goals, no jhanas, no enlightenment, no lunch. Nothing. You don't want anything. There's nothing to take you out of the present moment. Present moment is fine. What do I want to go anywhere else for? And understanding, oh, come on, the past, it's all dead. You can't actually relive the past, you can't change it. Unless, of course, you're Doctor Who. I used to watch Doctor Who when I was young. It's still apparently going. The Time Lords, the Time Travelers, and Daleks. The only thing I liked about that was when the Daleks used to say, exterminate, exterminate. So whenever I look at any of my defilements, exterminate, exterminate. I'm only messing around. But anyway, when the timeless present moment, you're right here. That's why sometimes people, they aren't asleep, they're sitting here, meditating, really enjoying themselves, so peaceful. And then they come out of meditation, wow, 3 hours? Clock must be wrong. Not wrong. Timeless. So I'm just going to finish off. I said I was going to do guided meditation, but I did do a little bit of guided meditation. And I was going to watch the spaces between the minutes, so not really what you expected, but there we go. this was the weird but true story of a monk who I will not say his name. If you want more details, ask Ajahn Siddhartha, see if you can get it out of him. But apparently, he was teaching this 9-day retreat over in the east of Australia somewhere. You know the 9-day retreats? And they used to get your rooms, and you get sort of orientation, and you come here, and half an hour meditation, then the talk. And so the monk was sitting up there here. Well, it's not in this place. Sitting up here, half an hour meditation, everybody was coming in, waiting for the first instructions. And when it got to 8 o'clock, the monk was still meditating. So he didn't open his eyes, and so they were just waiting out of respect, you know, to see when he was going to open his eyes and start the talk. 8:30, still hadn't opened his eyes. 7:45, and that was about the end of respect. So they decided to leave and go to bed. They left him there. Because they realized he wasn't going to talk, and they were tired. They were still meditating there at 9 o'clock, and so they all went back to bed, had a sleep. When they got up in the morning, he was still sitting there, hadn't moved. And so, you know, they sat there with him, and it was breakfast time. You know, he still hadn't moved. They went off for breakfast. They came back. He still hadn't moved. For 8 days, he never went to the toilet, never ate, never changed his posture, even the slightest. And he was just sitting there, just like a Buddha statue. And afterwards, when he came out of his meditation, just about 1 day to go, and he said, I apologize. And I just got into one of these really deep meditations, and I had my eyes in 8 days. Wow. And all the people, apparently, they said, wow, you don't need to apologize at all. That was such a wonderful Dhamma talk. That was inspirational. It can be done. And so they realized that the things which happened in the time of the Buddha can happen today. That was inspiring. Not forcing it. Not unconscious. Fully aware. Blissed out. Timeless. In the moment. Seeing a heaven in this little moment. That is cool. But I always say, if you don't believe it, try it out. You've got another 8 days to go, so just you can just fit it in. It's done now. Okay, so that's enough for this morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. We now have what's called interviews. Please keep it to 10 minutes each, because otherwise it won't be enough time to finish all the interviews, because I do have to go at 10:20 to go over to Bodhinyana Monastery. It's still holiday season over there. It's a long weekend, so there's lots of people come, so I have to be over there for them. And there's more interviews this afternoon.